This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of Tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have Jonathan Boston, the Professor of Policy Studies at Victoria University, and we'll be discussing with Jonathan why the report of the Independent Reference Group on Climate Adoption introduced by the current government is managed as considered by some as philosophically misguided and morally questionable. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to Community or Chaos.
Thank you, Marvin. Morena, everyone.
You were part of the expert working group that managed retreat chaired by Sir Terence Arnold about 3 or 4 years ago. And it was quite a different report than the one that the government's introduced. Could you explain why they rejected that report and went to the trouble of getting another report?
So just by way of background, the expert working group on managed retreat that I was part of had a membership of around a dozen people drawn from a wide range of backgrounds, law, banking, insurance, research, and local government. And we were asked by the Ministry for the Environment to essentially provide advice to the ministry and thus the government on how we could develop a comprehensive, effective, equitable, sort of resilient approach to the need to move people out of harm's way in the context of increasing climate-related risks, including more severe flooding and, over the longer term, coastal inundation as a result of sea level rise. And so we began that exercise in the middle of 2022 under the chairing of the former Chief Justice, Dame Shaun Elias. And we concluded our work about a year later in August 2023, 2 months before the general election. During that time, Dame Shaun had to stand down and was replaced by Sir Terence Arnold as the chair. Sir Terence was a former Supreme Court judge and also a former Solicitor General. So it was a high-powered team of people. It was a great pleasure to be involved, and we produced a very long report, almost 300 pages, with close to 90 recommendations covering a very wide range of issues related to managed retreat. That included some of the principles that should inform the policy framework. It included advice in relation to the planning process, the powers that the government might need, issues around risk assessment, issues of funding, who should pay for what on what basis, what sort of institutional changes there should be, and so forth. Now, it's pretty clear that while the previous government, the Labour-led government, was probably well disposed to much of the advice we offered, there were certainly elements in the then opposition, now the government, that didn't particularly favour some of our recommendations. And so not long after the change of government, the new government established this independent reference group on climate change adaptation to provide advice to the new government on what we should do.
If you don't like the message or the messenger, kill the messenger, right?
Well, I think this happens quite often, Marvin. If one government doesn't like the advice it receives, then it goes to another group of people. And if there's a change of government, the new government, if it doesn't like the advice that the previous government and received, it goes to a different group of people. Having said that, there was one person who was on both groups, Dr. Belinda Story. So she signed up to the report of the expert working group and then signed up to the report of the independent reference group, even though they say rather different things.
Was she happy with the outcome of the second report?
I certainly wasn't happy.
No, was she happy, the person?
Well, I presume she must have been, given that she's put her name to it.
Okay.
They're very, very different reports. The report of the expert working group, as I indicated, is a very long, detailed document that is pretty thorough, evidence-based, quite analytical. As I said, with almost 90 recommendations covering a wide range of matters. It's by no means the last word, Marvin. It's by no means complete, but it was the best we could do in the time we had available to us and with the resources we had at that time. I mean, for the point of view of viewers, you must, listeners, just bear in mind the issues we're covering, namely the challenge of adapting to the impacts of climate change over the coming decades, if not centuries. These are massively significant issues. They raise unprecedented challenges for humanity, locally and indeed globally. And we're going to be working on these issues as human beings for a very, very, very long time. This is a multi-generational challenge. So in terms of the...
Sounds like it's a multi-century challenge.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of the independent reference group, just so your listeners can understand, this is a very modest document. The full document runs to only 14 pages, but the main text of the document, excluding the executive summary, is only 10 pages, and it's fairly large typeface. So it's a very short document. It's a few thousand words compared with the document that I was party to, which was tens of thousands of words. And it's very thin. This independent reference group report is very thin in almost every respect, whether it's in relation to evidence, whether it's in relation to analysis, whether it's in relation to findings and recommendations. It's a very disappointing document in just about every possible respect.
One thing that's disturbed me about politics in recent years, the last 9 years or so, particularly in the last recent government, is the wholesale changes that each government, new government, seems to want to get rid of all the policies and advances or programs of the government they've just replaced. Seems very short term and very chaotic.
Mm. Yeah, so I think, Marvin, if we think about this sort of globally as well as locally, we're in a period of human history where we face enormous challenges, geopolitical, technological, ecological, demographic, socioeconomic challenges, huge.
Unfortunately, as an American, I'm well aware.
Yeah.
As a former American, I've been here since the early 70s, but I've certainly probably been more aware of what's going on in America than the average.
Yes, but what has happened, Marvin, is that the political community globally and in individual nations has become more fractured and polarized. And that polarization has been driven by a variety of forces, including the development of social media with its algorithms and echo chambers and so on. And I think that what we're witnessing here in New Zealand in recent years, with governments flip-flopping in terms of major areas of policy, reflects that fracturing of the, if you like, the political community, the increased polarization and division that we experience politically, and the fact that it's much harder now to get multi-party agreement or cross-party agreement on some of the really big policy issues we face. And I'm fearful that that will remain the case for a long time to come. Climate change is one of the biggest challenges humanity faces. And if we can't secure a cross-party agreement in countries like New Zealand or indeed the United States, then the problems are simply going to be all the bigger and all the more difficult to address. So one of the things that our expert working group was really keen to try and emphasize was the need for the building of some kind of cross-party consensus on how we should move forward to address the challenge that climate change is going to pose in terms of ever-increasing impacts on human settlements, properties, infrastructure, the natural world, and so on. And just a quick comment additional to this so that your listeners understand, the previous government prior to the election had established a process through the Environment Committee of Parliament, one of the select committees of Parliament, to take the report that I and others had produced, the Expert Working Group report, and a report which the ministry had produced alongside our report. The Environment Committee was invited to try and build a degree of cross-party support on the principles that should inform climate change adaptation policy. Then, of course, we had the election. After the election, that goal of seeking if we could build a cross-party support was continued by the current government, but the forum was shifted from the Environment Committee to the Finance and Expenditure Committee, reflecting, of course, the fact that there are big financial issues at stake here, not just environmental issues. Also reflecting the fact that the Finance and Expenditure Committee is probably the most senior policy committee of our parliament, and has more senior people sitting on it than the Environment Committee. And over the course of the first 6 months of last year, the Finance and Expenditure Committee deliberated and then produced a report about August last year from memory. And I gather that the effort to try and build a degree of cross-party support is continuing, but I rather suspect it's not going to be very successful, because if the government is wedded to the recommendations of the independent reference group, then those recommendations are clearly going to be unsatisfactory and not supported probably by the main opposition parties. And I'm happy to explain why I think that is the case over the coming interview period, Marvin. But there's lots of issues here, and there's lots of discussions going on. But we are in this much more fractured, polarized situation, and that's not helpful.
I wonder if part of this is the neoliberal experiment in the Western world is still part of our economy, but it's also become clear that it hasn't worked as some people hoped it would work, and so people aren't sure what to do now. What direction?
Yes, so I think the embrace of neoliberalism or market liberalism or economic rationalism, however you want to frame it, is a relevant consideration here. There are certainly elements in the current government, notably, of course, embodied in the ACT Party, but also within the National Party, that places a very strong emphasis on individualism, on private property rights, on reducing the role of the state, on minimizing regulation, and so on. And that is a well-established ideological or philosophical sort of position. The problem, Marvin, as I see it in a nutshell, is that what we're faced with in the context of climate change is increasing risk, and in particularly ever more damaging natural disasters. Indeed, we could talk in relation to sea level rise about, in effect, a kind of slow motion catastrophe that will impact enormously across the coastal areas of this country, and indeed every country with coasts, and do enormous damage. And in my view, given my sort of philosophical background, I think one of the most critical roles for a government is to help people manage and navigate natural disasters. In other words, a critical role for the state is to, in effect, ensure people through the mechanism of the state in the face of natural disasters. And we do that with earthquakes, but we're struggling to kind of think about how we do that with respect to climate-related impacts, because we haven't had in the past the sort of challenges that we're going to have in the future.
Now, what are the major deficiencies in the new report? We know the where they're coming from economically and so on, but what are the deficiencies in the report that quite upset many people?
Yes. So let me just quickly go through some of them, Marvin, and then we can expand on them. So for the benefit of listeners, this very thin report includes a number of recommendations that I support, one of them which is that we need more and better information about the risks we face. That's absolutely the case, and that information should be readily available to all members of the community. Secondly, it says we need a better planning framework for what is coming at us from the future, including trying to stop more development in areas that are going to be at significant risk from climate-related impacts, such as sea level rise. And I completely agree with that. But then when it sort of goes beyond that, I have a problem. And the three things that I'm most concerned about are these. The first is it says we should place a lot of weight on what's called the beneficiary pays principle. That is to say, the people who are going to benefit from some kind of adaptation response should pay disproportionately, if not fully, for the cost of that intervention.
User pay, in other words.
And that's the only principle they emphasize. So they don't emphasize other principles such as polluter pays or ability to pay or more sort of, if you like, community-based or solidaristic principles. While the beneficiary pays principle is a well-respected principle, it's limited, and it produces certain consequences that I think applied in this area could be extremely damaging from a social equity point of view. Secondly, the report suggests we should have a transition period from where we are now, in which the state will gradually reduce its level of support for adaptation, in effect, and particularly in relation to property buyouts, so that over the next 20 years, rather than the government buying out properties that are at very severe risk of damage from climate change, or possibly even indeed from seismic events, that level of assistance should be reduced. But it doesn't say how. It doesn't provide a framework for doing that, which is extraordinary. And then the third thing it says is that beyond 2045, which is 20 years from here, there should be no property buyouts. And any government assistance should in effect be limited, and it should not be in any way related to the value of the properties that are being damaged by the impacts of climate change, whether it's river flooding or coastal erosion or coastal inundation or whatever it might be. And I have a real problem with this idea of drawing a line in the sand in 20 years' time and saying beyond that temporal horizon, that temporal line in the sand, there is going to be no assistance of a particular kind. And I have all manner of reasons why I'm concerned about that, Marvin, and I'm happy to talk them through. But in a nutshell, I think that what is being recommended is open to severe moral questioning. I think it's economically questionable. I think it's administratively nightmarish and politically naive. I just don't think politically, at least if we remain a democracy, we will be able to maintain the kind of framework that they have in mind.
Should we be able to?
In the face of a rapidly expanding problem.
I mean,
it's rather like saying in the face of, I just give you an analogy, in the face of a situation where more and more people are getting cancer, you say, right, we're going to reduce the level of assistance for people with cancer over the next 20 years. And although the problem is going to be very much bigger in 2045, there'll be no assistance or very little assistance for people with cancer in 2045. You'll be on your own kind of thing. And I think that's lunacy, actually.
It's one thing for people with holiday homes or batches, but what about people who own the land in question or living on it and often making their living from the land? And they may not be able to afford to make the kind of move being in public high-risk areas will have financial problems around trying to transfer their business or sell it. And many of these people have been there for generations, some for 50 years and some for 350 years.
Yes, so let me talk that through, Marvin. It's a really good question. So the expert working group, in a nutshell, said we should prioritize government assistance for residential property as opposed to commercial property, and that would include agricultural property. And we argued that on the basis that one of the fundamental human needs is to have affordable and acceptable shelter. And that one of the things that we're going to face in the future will be a loss of housing because of sea level rise and more severe flooding and so on. So we said we should prioritize residential property over non-residential property in the main. We also said we should give priority to Māori land and facilities on the basis of the Treaty of Waitangi and in considerations of social justice and so on. Then we said, in relation to residential property, we should favour principal places of residence, i.e. where people spend most of their lives, rather than being too worried about second and third homes, people's batches, holiday homes, and so on. And we argued that partly on the basis of considerations of social justice, but also because, again, our concern is to ensure that everyone is housed. And if someone loses a holiday batch, well, they're not going to lose where they live. So what we said basically is that there should be property buyouts within a cap. And we can debate where that cap should be, but there should be property buyouts with a cap for residential properties that are the principal places of residence for people, but in effect, no property buyouts for second and third homes, holiday homes, and so on. But that we could provide some assistance for those second and third homes in terms of demolishing and removing those properties in the face of the oncoming tide. Now, when it comes to businesses and agricultural land and properties, Marvin, I think it's fair to say our report was relatively limited in its treatment of these issues. And that is partly because of the time we had available, but also because these are really, really complicated and difficult. But our basic proposition was there may be a need for some degree of government assistance, but it would probably need to be more discretionary than it would be for, if you like, principal places of residence. I think more work needs to be done on this. And let me tell you why. If we take a town like Westport, 4,000 people thereabouts, 2,000 residences, hundreds of businesses, apparently about $1 billion in infrastructure, including, of course, schools and social facilities of various kinds. Now, if a town like Westport needs to be moved, and that is open to debate, but my understanding is at some point later this century, the likelihood is, in the face of sea level rise, it may not be possible to protect Westport. If a town like that has to be moved, significant consideration is going to have to be given to the businesses in that town and how they are to relocate. If you're a business owner, say of a dairy or of a garage or whatever it might be, and the government says, okay, we'll buy out your residence up to a certain amount, a cap of $100,000, but then you provide no financial assistance to relocate the business, obviously there's going to be a serious challenge for that business owner. They'll lose all their equity. They may end up in debt. And what are they going to do? So I suspect when we begin to really think about moving whole towns and indeed suburbs like, say, South Dunedin over long periods of time, we can't just ignore the needs of businesses, particularly small businesses. And that would also potentially apply to farms, whether they're arable or horticultural or whatever. And there'd have to be some arrangement, it seems to me, for there to be some assistance provided. It probably wouldn't be based on the value of the land, because after all, the land is going to be ultimately, over time, lost. It's going to be inundated, and it will gradually move from being arable land or whatever it is to being a wetland and then maybe an estuary or whatever. So whatever assistance is provided, Marvin, to, you know, the areas that you've just raised, it will probably need to be based on considerations other than land values.
Okay, we'll have a piece of music now and then we'll come back.
Okay.
We're talking with Jonathan Boston on the report for the Independence Reference Group on Climate Adaption. And you can podcast this by going to oarfm.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Well, Jonathan, where do we go from here? What are our responsibilities and how do we continue to earn the trust of the people that were of New Zealand?
Well, look, Marvin, this is really complicated areas, but let me offer just a few quick reflections. As we address climate change and indeed other big challenges facing humanity and our local community, the first thing that I think is absolutely fundamental is that we adopt an evidence-based approach, which means we need good, robust evidence, recognizing, of course, that the future is uncertain. But the first thing we need to do is to be cognizant of what the best available scientific evidence is telling us about the nature and magnitude of the challenges we face. Then the second thing we need to do, having assessed that evidence and taken it seriously, is obviously to consider what the options are for us in terms of responding to that evidence. My understanding of the climate science at the moment is that we are going to face unprecedented impacts over the coming century and beyond in the form of more extreme weather events. That's more severe flooding, more severe storms, more severe wind events, more severe hailstorms, along with particularly later in the century, considerable and significant sea level rise going well into the coming centuries. And that these impacts are going to fundamentally alter the nature of where we can live and how we can live. And if we don't take that evidence seriously, well, there will be consequences. The second thing, or maybe the third thing, is that we need to have a principled approach to this. We need to know what our values are and why we value them. And from my perspective, I think one of the really critical things is that we should be minimizing harm to human beings and harm to the environment, and not just harm now, but harm over the long term. So that means we need, among other things, a precautionary approach, which means, among other things, we need to be proactive and not just reactive. One of the problems that we have faced in New Zealand and in many other countries in relation to climate change is that we've tended to be reactive rather than proactive. If we're going to minimize harm over the coming decades and beyond, we're going to have to be proactive. And that would mean, among other things, putting in place more cost-effective protective structures in the form of stronger stock banks where that is justified, but also moving people out of harm's way in advance of really severe damage from more severe flooding or coastal inundation. And that proactive, preemptive, precautionary approach, in my view, will serve us well. Another aspect of this in terms of principles, in my view, is that we should be seeking to minimize any increase in socioeconomic inequality, be it in relation to wealth or income. One of the obvious risks of climate change is that it's going to impact most severely on the least advantaged people, the people who have the least capacity to protect themselves. And the risk is that if we fail to put in place the right kind of combination of policies, then those people are going to suffer disproportionately. And that will be very bad, I believe, from a societal point of view. Marvin, among many things, we need to ensure that whatever policies we put in place are actually going to work, actually going to be effective and achieve the goals that we set, which among other things must be risk minimization, risk reduction, moving people out of harm's way, and enhancing the resilience of our society in the face of these unprecedented challenges. And then finally, just one other thing that's worth mentioning at this point is that as a result of climate change, the costs of residential and non-residential property insurance, the costs are bound to increase further. They've already increased dramatically around the world, including here in New Zealand, over the last few decades. Climate change will drive a further increase in residential and non-residential insurance premiums. And the risk of that is that, first of all, those premiums will become increasingly unaffordable, and therefore people will, particularly poorer people, will cease to insure their properties or not insure them adequately. And then the second will be that some properties will be uninsurable because of the risks that they face. And that will have consequences for those property owners and their communities. And then the third thing is that as property insurance declines across the community will become less resilient. And when impacts strike, in the absence of insurance, the capacity to rebuild and get back on your feet after a disaster has happened will be more difficult. So I think among the many sort of policy responses we need to be thinking about will be how do we maintain affordable and available insurance in the face of increasing climate-related risk?
Do you think if we took up the policies of the last report, that even our earthquake insurance, would that continue to be reliable?
Well, the independent reference group really make no reference at all to seismic risk or geophysical risk. And it's not clear to me reading their report whether they think that somehow we should change our approach in responding to major earthquake disasters, or whether we would have one approach for earthquakes and another approach for severe weather events. The report is simply silent on that, and I really don't know what the authors of the report think. But at the moment, here in New Zealand, and indeed in many other countries around the world, we have a degree of, if you like, community sharing or community pooling of risk in relation to major seismic events, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and so on, through what is now called the Natural Hazards Commission. It used to be EQC. But that only covers, in the main, it only covers seismic events. It doesn't cover severe weather events. I think there's a case for extending the cover of the Natural Hazards Commission to include severe weather events in addition to natural disasters from geophysical causes. But that's a huge topic itself, Marvin, and there's many possible ways of moving forward in that regard. But going back to your question, I simply don't know what the authors of the Independent Reference Group think about this, because it's not clear from their report what they think.
From what I've read of the report, and I've just read summaries, to be honest, there appear to be three main reasons for their refusal to or willingness to end all disaster-related property buyouts that are caused by climate change. One, they will become unaffordable. Secondly, the buyouts are unfair. And third, the prospect of a buyout can encourage risky decisions and bad investments.
Yeah.
Now, why are these reasons problematic?
Well, let's go through each of those arguments quickly. The first is that property buyouts in the future will be unaffordable. Well, various responses can be made to that claim. The first is that what is affordable is finally a moral or political decision. If they are saying that society as a whole won't be able to afford all these impacts, wow, well, that means presumably society as we know it will end. If the impacts are going to be so severe that we can't afford to deal with them, then we're going to see the unwinding of civilization. I don't think they're claiming that. I think they're claiming rather that it's going to be unaffordable for governments to buy our properties in the future. But that's essentially a political claim. It's not, if you like, a scientific claim. What governments choose to afford or not afford is a matter of moral and political judgment. And so my view would be what we need to think about here is what are the principles that should inform governments in determining what they spend their money on. Plainly, the expert working group don't think that property buyouts are justified, but they don't really provide very strong reasons for that. The second argument, and this builds on the first, is that somehow property buyouts would be unfair. Well, our expert working group grappled with that issue head on, and we sought to apply a range of principles of fairness to the question of who should fund what on what basis. And we came to the conclusion that it would be fair for the government to buy out some property owners to some extent. We argued that preserving wealth was not a core objective, so that we would not, at least the expert working group said, we should not be buying out multi-million dollar properties at multi-million dollar prices. We said there should be a cap on the amount of assistance, and that should be set at a relatively modest level. We also said that that buyout should be limited to certain types of properties, as I've described. And that if we applied those sorts of considerations, the model that we had in mind would be tolerably fair to taxpayers, ratepayers, property owners, and the wider community. And then the third concern they have, as you've mentioned, Marvin, is that if we provide buyouts, this will somehow encourage people to make risky decisions and bad investments. Well, I think what they're saying is that if people have some sort of confidence that if they build in a risky area and then they suffer some damage from a flood or whatever, that the that somehow the government will then come to their rescue, this will encourage people to continue to build and buy in risky areas. Now, there is the possibility that that will happen. It's called moral hazard. But I personally think moral hazard is exaggerated. But even if we take it really seriously, then my answer to that concern is that we should, by regulation, stop people from making unwise and risky decisions by stopping people building and buying in risky areas. And we can do that through our planning laws and regulations. And I think we should indeed. The independent reference group is of that view as well. So if we have proper regulation of land use planning and so on, we can avoid to a very significant extent the kind of moral hazard problem that property buyouts might generate.
It appears to many observers that the government's going in the opposite direction. They're deregulating instead of regulating for climate change.
Well, it seems to me, Marvin, we've got a government that's, how can I put it, inconsistent. Yes, on the one hand, in general terms, it's a government that wants to deregulate. On the other hand, in relation to climate change, when it comes to land use planning, there are certainly elements within the government that recognize that simply letting things rip and letting people build and buy wherever will be damaging from a long-term point of view. And therefore, we need to strengthen the capacity for local governments to regulate land use in ways that will minimize long-term risk. But which element within the government wins on this, I don't know. But there's clearly tensions here. And bear in mind, and I understand the nature of the problem here, you know, we've had a significant housing shortage. In some areas in New Zealand, there isn't that much land available for new housing development. Some of the land that is available is potentially at risk in the longer term from climate change. So I can understand the political pressure to allow development to occur in areas that may be at some point at risk of some flooding or coastal inundation. But in my view, we should stand against that and say no. There's no point allowing property development in areas that we have reasonable confidence will be at risk over the next X period of time, not least because the cost of then removing these properties and all the infrastructure associated with them, Marvin, is going to be very significant.
One of the things that I think we're observing is that the government has an economic policy of austerity and not raising taxes or wealth taxes or capital gains or other taxes to pay for the infrastructure that we need and also prepare for climate change. So you've got two different things. You've got a climate change situation where the risk is getting worse. The cost is probably getting worse with time, yet governments are unwilling to consider proper taxation.
Yes, Marvin. So one of the big issues we face is this, if you like, ideological debate about the role of the state and the size of the state in terms of public expenditure and therefore the revenue that's required. But related to that is, if you like, the temporal dimension of this. And there is a very strong incentive sometimes for governments to focus on the short run, and you mentioned this earlier in this conversation, at the expense of the long term. But to the extent that you know there's a big problem coming and you decide not to invest to protect yourself against that big problem and to reduce the scale and scope of that problem, to the extent that you do that, you are in effect transferring the problem to people living in the future, which may be our future selves in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years' time, as well as people who are yet to be born. And I kind of think, well, if you're interested in and concerned about issues of intergenerational fairness, and you know there's going to be a big problem, and you know how you can minimize that big problem, then it's immoral not to seek to invest appropriately and cost effectively to minimize that big problem. Unfortunately, of course, if you're wedded to the view that we need always to be reducing the role of the state and reducing taxes and reducing expenditure, irrespective of what's coming at us from the future, well, then we're simply going to load the dice against people living in the future in ways that I think will be very, very harmful. But Marvin, I've been working on these issues, as you know, for a long time, and I sometimes feel quite despairing. Because politically, it's so easy and attractive to say, let's cut taxes, let's reduce expenditure. It's so much harder politically to say, actually, we need to increase taxes in order to address this problem that's on the horizon. Indeed, it's not just on the horizon, it's slapping at our feet now. But if we fail, then the costs are going to be larger and they're going to have major consequences for lots of people.
Don't we need, this is one case where we actually need leadership. I mean, we need to have a leader of a, say, the Labour Party or some other party, explain why taxation can actually be good for society as a whole. Not just for the future, but good for society now. For instance, you may be able to get your hip replaced or have your cardiac surgery done if we're willing to pay taxes for health care. So there isn't that. We aren't having a discussion about taxation. Not a real discussion. And maybe that's one of the things we have to have urgently.
Yes. Well, I mean, Marvin, we have as a society had debates about taxation from time to time over many decades. I'm sure that in the coming year, there will be more vigorous discussion about tax reform because the Greens have proposed significant changes to the tax regime and the Labour Party looks likely to propose major changes to the tax regime. It's pretty clear that there are many people in the business community and indeed in the public service that favour some degree of tax reform. Plainly, the current government is opposed to any significant tax reform. So I'm sure there will be a debate. What the outcome of that debate will be will depend obviously partly on what happens at the next election and the election after that. And we'll have to wait and see. But it would be fair to say, Marvin, there are some issues that how can I put it, politicians struggle to discuss because of the potential for political harm. I mean, fundamentally, the challenge of climate change adaptation is an unattractive one politically. There are no votes in climate change adaptation. There's only, in effect, costs and losses, at least in the short to medium term. The people who will benefit from the investments that we should be making include people who don't have the vote at the moment and may not even be alive. And so politically, they don't count. and the politics of this is really hard. When local governments try and involve their communities in discussing how we're going to address sea level rise, for example, or more severe riverine flooding, it's really hard for them because they have people saying, oh, you're exaggerating the risks. The scientists are simply there trying to make money for themselves or consultants or something like that. People will say, you know, there are cheaper ways of dealing with this than the evidence suggests. People will be very keen to protect their own interests. And the local governments and central governments in this context kind of are caught between a rock and a hard place. They want to do the best for their community often, but they realize that whatever they suggest is going to be badly received politically. And I don't know what the solution to this is, Marvin. I really don't.
Shouldn't there be a discussion also, not just of taxation, but of the idea that the legitimacy of government really exists on the willingness of government to govern for the common good, not only of this present generation, but future generations, the common good of our grandchildren?
Absolutely, Marvin, yes. But of course, people have differing views about what the common good means and how it can be achieved. But just quickly going back to your point about leadership, I do think political leadership is critically important. And I think in relation to climate change adaptation, with some exceptions, we've not had the level and degree of political leadership that would be desirable. And that applies nationally as well as at the subnational level. I recognize, as I've said earlier, that this is really challenging for politicians. But we elect people to lead. And if people put themselves forward to lead, then they have some obligation, some duty to provide leadership. If they're not willing to provide leadership, then seems to me they should stand down and let other people come forward. But you know, this notion of being really concerned for the public interest, the common good, and the common good, as you say, spread over multiple generations, is absolutely vital. And so in this area of policy, climate change adaptation, we very much need to think broadly. We need to think long term. We need to think about investing today for tomorrow.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jonathan, for discussing the necessity of preparing for climate change, the ethical and financial responsibilities we have toward the present generation, but also the future generation, and to realistically face what needs to be done for climate change. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Marvin. Appreciate the opportunity. All the best.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.